All right, guys, you pass out a little bit of beer and wine at the end of a conference, oh, yeah, and things get out of control here. We're going to get started here. So appreciate have everyone sit down. And while you're sitting down, I'll tell you a little story. The last time we passed out wine, if some of you might remember, I know Kelly Brooks was there. It was in Miami. I think in about 2006, we handed out the 4C wine. And this is actually an e-discovery tool based on Zuba Lake. There were 3 C's in Zuba Lake: communicate, coordinate, comply. And the 4C is Cabernet, when the first three get messed up. And for those of you who grab a bottle, Judge Shinlin was kind enough to autograph the front, Laura Zuba Lake the back. And I find it to be an indispensable e-discovery tool. So it does tie in to the educational content of what we're trying to cover here, so believe it or not. So anyway, again, you know, my name is Carl Shinneman. I'm a president and founder of ReviewLess, and you know, welcome here to Carmel Valley e-discovery retreat, potentially again listening to another ESI Bites program. So I'm going to say here, we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free on the internet and available when you're interested in downloading it and listening to it. And I want to thank you all to listen to this panel. This is sort of a panel of power users of advanced analytics and predictive coding, and when I handpicked this panel to be the bookend of the judicial panel last fall, I first of all, I appreciate ESI Bites because you get to talk to people that are passionate about their space and identify people to get involved with, you know, talking about what they know, and you know, finding people that understand what they're doing is always a challenge. I mean, I think it's always useful to have people talk about things they believe that are going to be occurring, and that's part of the educational process. But here we really do have people that are actually using these tools, and we're going to talk about some of the hot issues that, you know, there are some disagreement over. And I promise you there'll be some disagreement. We've already warmed everyone up for a fight. Dave Lewison is in the middle to break it up if anything gets out of hand. But again, we're at the beginning of a stage of an exciting area here, and these are GPSs to some extent. There are lots of ways to get to the same answer. So we're going to try to draw some of those out. I want to introduce this incredible panel. We've got Maura Grossman sitting in the middle, who's in the left corner wearing trunks and whatever. She's counsel at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosenkatz. She oversees electronic discovery for the firm and its clients, and she's co-chair of the eDiscovery Working Group advising the New York State Unified Court System, co-coordinator of the legal track of the National Institute of Standards and Technologies Text Retrieval Conference, better known as TREC, and a member of the steering committee on the Sedona Conference Working Group 1 on Electronic Document Retention and Production. Moore is an adjunct professor at Columbia Law School, and along with Professor Gordon Cormack, who's sitting up here in the front, who's a professor at the University of Waterloo, wrote one of the leading articles on technology-assisted review. In addition to her law degree from Georgetown University, she also holds an MA and PhD in clinical psychology from Adelphi University. Sitting in the other corner, Tom Grix, is a partner in the litigation department of Schneider, Harrison, Siegel, and Lewis. He's chairman of its electronic discovery practice group, director of its litigation support group. He's a seasoned trial attorney with a focus on complex commercial litigation, environmental litigation, construction litigation. He serves as an e-discovery special master with the United States District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, is a frequent lecturer on e-discovery practices with a primary focus on predictive coding. And earlier this year, Tom was successful in riding that horse that disappeared from the Craig Ball's presentation, obtaining the first and only court order in the country authorizing the use of predictive coding over the objection of the opposing party in the Global Aerospace versus Landau Aviation case. Tom's background includes a chemical engineering degree from Carnegie Mellon University and period as an in-house counsel with Westinghouse Electric Corp.
Carl, can I interpret that in Craig Ball-ese?
Okay.
For those of you who don't know, my name is really Zizou Zwit. and I was the jockey that rode the lead horse called that state court case that nobody really cares about. So, just so you know.
So, anyway, Bennett Borden, Tom's the reason we're drinking beer here. He wanted to have a friendly beer with Maura Grossman to talk about this disagreement. It turned into a group beer session, so we all benefit. Bennett Borden is a partner at Williams Mullen and chairs its Electronic Discovery and Information Government section. He's the chair of the Cloud Computing Committee and vice chair of the eDiscovery and Digital Evidence Committee of the ABA and editor-in-chief of the Sedona Conference's Cloud Computing Commentary. He's on the steering committee of the D.C. Bar eDiscovery Committee and on the advisory board of the D.C. chapter of ARMA and the Georgetown Paralegal Studies Program. He's involved in several thought leadership groups and a guest lecturer on eDiscovery and Information Governance at the Georgetown University Law Center and University of Virginia. We could have another fight between the computer scientists here. I'm not sure. I'm thinking about past conversations. But anyway, Dr. Herb Reuplatt is the co-founder of Orchitech, a predictive coding and data analytics software company. Before starting Orchitech, Dr. Reuplatt was chief scientist and a co-founder of Dolphin Search, as well as an award-winning professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. He's been awarded two patents and has one patent pending on conceptual search technology. Dr. Reuplatt is widely recognized as an expert in search and retrieval technology, particularly in the area of e-discovery. He was the core inventor of the Dolphin Search Neural Network software that introduced concept search to the e-discovery market. He's also the core inventor and designer of Orchitech Document Decisioning Suite, including Orca Predict, its predictive coding system. He's been a member of the Sedona Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, on the advisory board of the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced e-discovery Institute, a member of the 2011 Program Committee for the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced e-discovery Institute, and co-founder of the Electronic Discovery Institute. He's a frequent speaker on e-discovery, particularly concerning search, categorization, predictive coding, and quality assurance.
And I was the trainer of the horse.
And I was I fed it, you know. So, you know, anyway. I cleaned up the crap. I was on the review side. That's right. But anyway, Dr. Dave Lewis, our last panelist, is a Chicago-based consultant on information retrieval and applied statistics, data mining, natural language processing, and electronic discovery. He co-founded the Trek Legal Track and created the first large-scale public test set for e-discovery. Dr. Lewis previously held research positions at AT&T Labs, Bell Labs, and the University of Chicago, and has published more than 75 scientific papers and has 8 patents. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He served as a consulting or testifying expert on e-discovery in a number of federal cases, including Clean Products versus Packaging Corporation of America. So with that in mind, let's start us off.
And I'm allergic to horses.
So Bennett, starting off, do you disclose the use of analytical tools to the other side, and what are some of the pros and cons?
You know, it really depends on whether or not it furthers my litigation ends. That said, I almost never do. The only time that I really need the other side sign off is if I need it, because basically the way that we look for documents, it's my deal. I could have trained magic monkeys looking for documents. It doesn't matter. What matters is, do I comply with my legal responsibilities, and is the result correct, and do I do that in a way that is unassailable? If I can do that, then I don't care. I don't tell them. That said, there are times when the case is big enough, the documents are big enough, where I really got to get some sign off on it. And those very few occasions, then I will.
By the way, Carl, I wanted to ask a question. Bennett and I have actually talked about this, and I'd also open it up to anyone else who wants to talk about some of the problems that come up. But one of the questions that I have is how do you deal with the situation that I was faced with, which was a call with 4 pages worth of keywords, and let's negotiate keywords to call this down.
Typically, I'm a big fan of, I call it the facts-first approach, right? I get way ahead of the data. So as soon as there's the first whiff of a case, so if I've got a triggering event, I go scramble after the data very, very quickly. And so well before I even start talking to the other side, I've already got my custodians tiered up. I'm going after the most important data. I've already analyzed it. I've already put it through my magic review tools. I've done the terms that come out of that. So when they come to me with terms, I say, all right, I've already done this one, here's the set, here's the random sample, here's what's working, here's what doesn't. So I kind of head that whole conversation off, if I don't just tell it to pound sand. Sometimes when they come to me with search terms, I say, I've got this under control. I know what my responsibilities are. I am finding these documents, and if we have a problem, we can talk about it after I produce.
Tom, great. I'd like to hear what you said there.
The answer that I had was, no, I don't want to do that. It was that simple. I don't want to use keywords because I don't find them to be very effective, and I'm concerned that I'm going to miss documents. And actually, from my perspective, I'm more a litigator, as much a litigator as I am an e-discovery attorney, and from my perspective, the key is making sure I find the documents. And so I told him I really don't want to do that. I'd really just rather use predictive coding because we've got about 2 million documents. Let's just put it in. Let's get them done. Let's get the documents out there and let's litigate the case. And that's how that dialogue starts.
There's also a compromise position. I would take all the keywords and I would use those keywords to find documents to create my seed set or my training set, because keywords are good. If you do a Google search, you're going to find some good things at the top. Well, I would use those keywords to help me find a set. So I would say to Craig, bring them on. Give me all the keywords you want, and I will use a relevance ranking algorithm and throw all those keywords into a relevance ranking algorithm, let it bubble up to the top, the 1,000 or 2,000 it thinks are the best combination of those keywords, the most unique combination of those words, and those are the ones I'm going to start to look at first to develop my seed or training set.
The gloves are off. You've skipped the question. Tom, what's your approach?
I really don't like keywords. So the first step that I really jump to when I have huge data sets like I was dealing with is, let's talk about how to deal with it. Let's talk about whether we can use predictive coding to get there. And I will. I'm not someone who likes to use keywords at all. And I think you kind of disclose when you say I'm going to use keywords to create a relevance ranking. And I don't prefer seed sets. I mean, there are really, as I think Craig laid out, there are two general ways to do it: seed sets and training sets, random. Or there may be a joint way to do it, and I have my own feelings about which one tends to point the tools in the direction I think it should go. But I was having this discussion with Maura, who explained that she goes through a much more detailed and more involved process than just a couple of seed set documents. So I prefer a random approach, but I hear what Craig Ball says, there may be room for doing both.
Well, and there's also, I mean, keywords have their place, but I typically go after data without keywords, right? Because there's usually only four or five people involved in the case that really matter, my top-tier folks. And I analyze their data and let that data inform the search terms. And then you run these iterative processes so that you've got some basis for the search terms, right? So I think they've got their place. I just tend not to let the other side direct that process. I take it over.
What does analyze the data mean?
Well, so typically what we do is we find the people involved across a time frame that was fairly critical, and we literally just do an analysis, a review of a set of documents around that time frame. And sometimes, look, some cases are more amenable to search terms than others, right? So like a case about a contract or a product or whatever, that's really easy to do. A discrimination complaint isn't. What are they going to type? I hate you? Right? I mean, how are you going to search for that? And so by getting into the data that I think is relevant and then letting the data inform the terms, that's where I find I get out of a lot of fights about search terms.
I'm going to jump in and help the computer scientists because they're getting overrun by the litigators here. there are different approaches here, and so if you want to throw out your perspective on this and sort of define some of the approaches and maybe react to some of the random versus seeding type of discussions that we were having there. If you want to start, Herb and then Dave.
Sure. I mean, I'm not a great fan of keywords. I think it biases the results that you're getting. If keywords were always under-inclusive, I'd be more inclined to do that. But they're also terribly over-inclusive, and we see terrible horror stories of insurance company cases involving a request that we search for the word life, which is every document in the set. Because in the disclaimer it says, you know, so-and-so life insurance company. So I'm not inclined to do that. I think it's a lot of time and a lot of effort. The random sampling is something that I think is less biased and in the end is less effort. If you want to add things to it and you want to employ Maura's approach and you're as clever as Maura is, then I think there's lots of room for doing that too. But I think on the whole, it's just too much work. Now I'll let Dave talk and then I want to talk some more about some other approaches.
Well, I'll weigh in briefly that I guess I fall on Maura's side in that if you've got any sort of information which, mostly what we're talking about with TAR is supervised learning approaches, learning from examples. And if you can start out the system with documents that are cluing on what some of the important key terms are, then the system doesn't have to stumble, and you're sort of farther up the learning curve at the beginning. On the other hand, I would say I view that distinction as less important than whether the system supports what's called active learning or not. And active learning is when the system chooses which training examples it's going to show you after you kick it off. And you can kick it off with random, in which case it's going to be a little slower to get started, or you can kick it off with a seed set, in which case it's going to get faster to get started. But very quickly, the algorithm is going to take over figuring out what examples it can learn the fastest from.
George wanted to ask a question back here. So.
Yeah. So I've got a question that's slightly different than what you're talking about right now, but it's something I've been wondering about with respect to technology-assisted review.
Yeah.
And that is that, as, for example, Craig was talking about earlier, or others have said, it's no doubt very good, and I think it is very good, at finding more of the same. But I know that from the 16 years that I was a litigation attorney, often what I wanted to find most, in terms of an econometrician that I worked with for a while, would put it, was the outliers. The things I had no idea I might have any interest in, but once I was able to find them, became of critical importance. So how does technology-assisted review help in finding those outliers that I don't even know I want to know about?
Well, whether you start with random or you start with a seed set, if you do some random sampling of the documents, then you have a good chance of finding things that you didn't expect. The issue comes if you never have any way of... You get your chance in a second.
It's the fight.
If all you do is follow what you expect to be there, then you don't have an opportunity of finding new things. I like to think of the random sampling as being the Potter Stewart approach to responsive documents. I mean, I may not know exactly how to describe them, but I know them when I see them.
Okay, let me give you an example from a real case that I worked on a week or two ago. 1.1 million documents. There were about, after we were done, 985 potentially responsive documents. And we were aiming for at least 70% recall, if not better. So our null set would have 300 relevant documents, or we had a prevalence of 0.03%. Now, if I did random sampling, I'd only have one responsive document in 3,000. Now, if I sat a senior person down at a computer at my firm and showed them 3,000 documents to find one responsive document, that is not a good way to go about searching. It's not.
I don't disagree with that, yeah. By the way.
So, with low prevalence, that kind of random sampling is not going to work.
Well, and Maura, this brings up a very good point, right? I am not yet sold on the supervised learning model. I have used it many times in real cases, but more importantly, I have literally done head-to-head tests with a dozen of these tools, where I've got a test set of data, I know what's in it, and we run through these supervised learning models. I haven't made it work well yet, and that may be because I haven't developed a protocol around making it work well. But my technology-assisted review is around finding patterns in data. So the tools that I use are what we more classify as clustering technologies or topic imputation technologies. And I find that we've been incredibly successful using those on cases. What I find the problem with the supervised learning is I have not yet had a test where it's been 60%, more than 60% of the documents have I kept the coding that the prediction made. And so that is a big problem for me. The second is that when we do doc requests, there's like 57 doc requests, and you can maybe group them into topic areas, but that means you typically have to run a supervised learning on each topic because it doesn't do well when you've got five different topics in a responsive document. And so I've just not yet been able to find a way to make it work terribly effectively in my practice.
Let's talk.
All right. Back to George's question. Yeah. I have not found that to be a problem. And again, I'll give you a real example from a real case. Did an FCPA investigation, and this document kept coming up that was called, and what we were looking for was gifts, things of value given to government officials. And this document, this spreadsheet kept coming up that had the word Pachi on it. And we just kept marking it non-responsive junk. We had no ideas, just some list. And then one day I decided, this Pachi keeps coming up, and I don't know what Pachi is. Well, Pachi turns out to be an expensive chocolate like Godiva chocolate. And on this Pachi list was the name of an official. So how did the algorithm find it? I had no clue that that was a relevant document. It figured out that that was an important document, and it kept giving it to me 2, 3, 4 times until I decided I better go find out why it keeps giving me this document. So it's an interaction between me and the computer. I had to be smart enough to figure out, okay, the algorithm keeps giving me this document. There's something about it that it thinks is responsive. I need to go the extra step and find out why. I did some Googling and I spoke to some people, and it was the Christmas gift list.
Well, first off, I want to say that if we have 3%, 0.03% responsive documents, nothing is going to work really well in that kind of collection, because you'd be right 99.97% of the time by always saying no. People at best are, you know, we live in an 80% world. To expect that any kind of process is going to be more effective than 99.97% is kind of questionable.
But we found the documents in 6 hours using technology-assisted review.
Well, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying that, in general, you'd be right almost all the time. 99.97% is pretty much almost all.
This is why we don't use accuracy as a measure in information retrieval. I mean, when you do a Google search, it's quite common for you to be essentially creating a text classifier which is sorting out documents that occur at a frequency of 1 in 1 billion.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, 3 in 10,000 is not a big deal at all if you've got some prior knowledge to build your seed set with. Obviously, you're not going to do very well if you have to use random sampling to build your training data.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you get in a situation like that, I, too, would not use random sampling to do
practically
it.
Speaking, we don't care what they say.
Just doesn't mean that everything has to be a nail. Sorry,
Tom? I said, practically speaking, you guys are going like this to me. I don't understand. 0.0 gazillion, 3%. But part of the issue that comes up with this is, it takes time to develop that seed set, and I would never, ever suggest doing even a random sample without studying your data. You have to know the data. Maura does it. She finds seed documents that she likes to use. When I do it, I look at the data. I find the kind of documents that I think are really responsive, and frankly, I won't be ready to say the tool is stabilized until I have seen those documents in my random set. I'm comfortable that I know the computer has seen them and is looking at them and saying, yep, those are relevant. So it's kind of a hybrid anyway, and so we don't have that much disagreement. That's
the GPS-ness of it. And just quickly, Tom, you know, what's the sort of length of time you see in doing that type of process?
Well, look, the tools that I like to use are tools that don't require you to spend inordinate amounts of time reviewing documents. You spend a day or two looking really seriously at what the data is telling you. You can look at timelines, you can look at domains, you can look at senders, recipients, concept searches. Find out what the data is telling you. So let's say that takes 2 days. You can then take it and review documents at a pace that no one ever sees in a review. And by the way, this is different than what Bennett was talking about. It's not a responsiveness review as much as it is, in my world, a culling, a relevance analysis. And you can review 5,000 documents in 2 or 3 days. And at the end of 3 days, you can look at it and say, I think I've really seen everything I need. The tool's stabilized, and we're ready to go. So, you know, we're talking a week.
We got a question from the audience here.
So, you guys are talking about random sampling, and I'd like to bring it back. One of the things that I see very regularly in these large collections is that they're not uniform. And it's one of the things that you know, it's how do you tackle that? What are the techniques around it when the collections themselves are not in uniform distribution? The many of the algorithms that are the systems are geared on for calculating statistical frequency and sampling size are based on relatively uniform distribution when they're not in the samples. Yeah. And when we don't have many times the entire collection when we start the process. We start the process. And it's iterative and it's rolling.
Yeah. So I think one thing that's important to distinguish there is the use of random sampling for producing a training set, which is what we've largely been talking about here, and the use of random sampling for evaluating the system afterwards. And there's no difficulty whatsoever with the use of random sampling to evaluate the system, regardless of the degree of inhomogeneity in the collection. There may be problems, let's say, for instance, to take an extreme case, if you had a collection that was 95% English and 5% Chinese, you're going to have some real problems with training a single classifier for that, and you'll have particular problems if you're doing that by random sampling, and it wouldn't make sense. You should split that. You should do two different collections or whatever. But for evaluation, there's no issue.
A uniform distribution is not the assumption. The assumption has to do with each document having an equal chance of participating.
So let's talk a little bit about null sets. That's another place where, you know, we can put the gloves back on. There's a lot of, we've heard over the last day or so, you know, different points of views about work product and, you know, what some of the risks are of handing over null sets. I don't know who wants to chime in for it. Maura, you would win the race if we had the horse thing going. But anyway, go ahead.
The last time I read the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, they required me to produce responsive, non-privileged documents or documents reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. I didn't see anything that said that non-responsive documents were either of these things. It's never been required in the past, unless I don't have to give over a hard drive for inspection without review, unless there's misconduct. I think that it raises serious issues of confidentiality and fiduciary duties that I have to my client. I had a recent matter where we were looking for evidence of a particular fraud. We found evidence of another fraud. I didn't think it would be in my client's best interest to hand over those documents. I think Tom is going to tell you that you can cherry pick, and if they're not sensitive, then you can hand them over. But I think that's even worse, to have Tom figuring out which ones are sensitive and which ones aren't sensitive. Or he'll tell you we can do a withholding log, but we all know how well privilege logs work and how costly and time-effective they are. I've never seen any empirical evidence that shows that non-responsive documents give me any insight into the quality of the process that the other person has used, and whether I agree or disagree with their stupid coding about 10 documents still doesn't tell me whether their process was sound. So what do I think? I think the bigger issue is whether somebody's training their system on everything that's been marked responsive or not responsive. I don't know if you've been following Ralph Losey's blog, where he's been talking about a method where he makes decisions about whether to train on things and not train on things. And I think if we're going to have a fight, that's the fight that we should be having, because that scares me to death, that somebody's sitting there making decisions about what the algorithm might do when they don't even know how the algorithm works. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I advise requesting parties also. So, Craig, I would advise, if I were in your shoes, that I would give the other side input into search terms for helping to find the seed sets. I agree with you completely about synthetic documents. I have no problem with that. Train on all responsive or non-responsive documents. You mark the document as responsive, you mark the document as non-responsive, you defer it, and you train on all of them. You don't cherry pick. I think that's a far bigger issue than haggling over non-responsive documents, because those arguments, and I think in Judge Peck's case, are really arguments about scope. They're not really arguments about particular documents. And we're never going to completely agree on scope. So I'd rather get metrics from the other side. I'd rather get the distribution of scores of the documents. I'd rather understand the sampling they've done. But I don't advise my clients to ask for to look at the non-responsive documents. I don't think it tells me anything about the process.
And Tom, that was nice. Moore answered the question for you, too. Do you have anything to add?
I was going to say, to paraphrase a comment I once made to a judge when a lawyer similarly made an argument about what I was going to say, if they had wanted to hire Moore, they would have. They hired me. So I get to tell you what I think about this. The interesting thing, I thought about this, and Moore talked to me about process. Process tells you nothing. You need two data points with process. You need to know what went in or what came out. You need to know one of those two. It's nice to know you got a great process, but if you don't put the right stuff in, process doesn't give you the right stuff out. And there's no way to know that. Here's the thing. I want to do this. See, my background is litigation, and my theory is I don't want to waste a lot of time and effort on discovery. I'm just sorry, that's the point. I don't want to do it. I want to get the documents into the system, and I want to get the case tried, okay? So that's my goal. The way that I find relevant documents is this. I run the tool. I will take the relevant documents, take all the privileged documents, put them on a privilege log, and say, here are the relevant ones, here are the privileged ones, let's talk about them if you've got a problem. I will take all the non-relevant documents in the training set, and I will take out the privileged ones and the sensitive ones, and I won't make that decision. I'll let my client tell me what they believe is sensitive after I talk to them. But in any event, I still log them. In fact, I've logged jokes because there are some off-color jokes that make it through sometimes, and you want to be able to say, yeah, that was personal communication unrelated to the case. And if I have to talk to a lawyer about it, I can. But the point is, I want them to see that because opposing counsel and I may disagree about what is relevant. And the gold standard, at least two of them are sitting over at that table, and the gold standard is the judge. So if we disagree, they're going to come to me and they're going to say, no, I think these ought to be marked as relevant. And if I'm okay with that, I'll put them in, I'll change the training, and I will run it. And at the end of the day, they'll be happy that they have a set of documents generated from a good training set. If we disagree, I'll go to the judge, or they'll go to the judge, and we'll say, tell me if it's relevant. If the judge says to me it's relevant, I was wrong. I should have coded it as relevant. There's nothing I can do about that. I don't want to do this process twice. So let me turn over the training set. You tell me what you think is relevant or not relevant, where I've made mistakes. We'll figure out what we should do to retrain the tool if we have to. And then we'll run it once, get the relevant documents out, make sure they're okay, and get the case tried.
Let's ask Judge Fisher. I want to ask Judge Peck, since that would be not a good thing. There are 3,300 documents out of 15,000 that the parties disagreed on. Do you want to be sitting and making decisions on relevance on 3,300 documents?
No, let's clarify. There were 3,300 documents that would be non-relevant. The disagreement would probably be over three. Will you deal with three?
There's a lot more than three.
That's not how my work
goes. The gloves. I think Tom won that round, okay? So go ahead.
Now, obviously, we wouldn't always have the time to deal with 3,300 documents, and there may be even instances when we don't have the time to look at three. And there may also be instances where, as the judge on the case, depending on what the arguments are, you may even decide that initially a special master needs to look at it or a magistrate judge. And our system in the Western District's a little bit different, as Tom and Carl know, because our magistrate judges are on the wheel, and we, as the district judges, generally do all of our own discovery. But frankly, you know, if I had to look at them all, I would do it. And the way I operate, I do my own discovery issues, because my clerks, two of them are rookies rotating out, one's a five-year attorney, and so I think you need the experience as a litigator to look at cases and determine, you know, whether this is relevant or not. So I signed up for this duty. If I have to do it, I have to do it.
See, and I've got kind of a middle ground between both of you. I almost never turn over my null set. What I am willing to do is I'll agree on a confidence interval and level. We'll agree on a sample set. I'll get a random sample out, and I'll do the review of the null set and say, okay, 0.02% were relevant. And so then try to cut, and maybe we'll look at those documents and figure out how I need to retrain or something, but I typically will not. Now, there are two cases where I have, where we've been able to, it was a part of the agreed upon protocol from the beginning. We had sensitive stuff logged. We had attorney's eyes only on the non-responsive stuff. So there's times I have done it, but usually I just simply don't get into that for Mora's reasons, right? So, but again, all this is about what will further my litigation end. And if I have to do it to get that done, I will. But frankly, most of the time, the other side simply isn't sophisticated enough to deal with this. It's pearls before swine, right? And so you can't deal with the pearls. The pearls are the pearls. And so all you got to deal with is the swine. So honestly, I have learned, and Mora will laugh at me for this, that I have become less transparent than I used to be, because it just causes me trouble, because the other side simply doesn't know what they're doing.
By the way, Carl,
sign that's on your back.
Go ahead, Tom.
Kick me.
Before you go on, I'd like to prove that I'm a geek engineer, because I told you about this. If you do, the other interesting point is, I thought about Morris' point on this, that you really don't have to turn over non-relevant documents, is if you look at Morris' excellent studies, it tells you that people typically turn over 30 to 40% non-relevant documents out of the data set they're looking at. At the end of the day, a linear review will turn over more non-relevant documents than you do by turning over the training set and all non-relevant documents through your predictive coding production. So I don't get that uptight about it when I do it. And because I'm logging sensitive documents and taking those fights to the judge if we have to, I don't worry about it as much.
Don't you think some of the debate is occurring because if you're seeding, you're aiming at documents that you think are related to the case, and that might infer some work product, whereas if you're random sampling, it's what's spitting out at you, and it's just coming out at the edges. And, you know, maybe that is part of the cause of where the friction is. Because work product's important. I mean, we all agree on that. We're all lawyers here.
From a technology point of view, I want to ask the question of what are these documents supposed to tell you? I mean, I've heard people say, look, there's an emotional aspect to it, that the non-responsive documents help me to help the other side to feel like they're getting what they want. It helps them to have confidence in me. But is it telling them anything about the technology? No, it's not. It's designed maybe to overcome an emotional thing, and maybe that's what it takes. Maybe that's what Tom's talking about. Whatever the facts are, I want them to feel like they got a good deal, whether they got a good deal or not.
Nah, I'm not a real emotional guy. No, the issue is, what's the quickest way for me to get someone to agree with me that this process is going to produce the documents that I need, and for me to be able to be comfortable that, you know, we've vetted what is truly relevant in this case before we press the button. That's it. Yeah, no, Herb, I'm not worried about it.
You were lucky. If we look at DeSilver Moore, that's not how it went down.
Completely different case.
Completely different case, but that is just as likely as the other outcome.
But those issues, but by the way, this leads to a very good practice tip. Bring it up early. Yeah, go to state court in Virginia.
Who cares?
Bring it up early. If I can, would prepare an ESI case management order from the get-go and say, look, this is what we're going to do. And negotiate that issue up front and get that all out of the way early so that we're not going to fight about these things later as they come up. So I try to get it out of the way early, get it basically in a court order so that we all know what we're dealing with and the judges know what we're dealing with, and we can run the process and get through this discovery issue as quickly as we can.
I have a little bit of a debate with Carl about how common the use of predictive coding or TAR is in the industry. Can the three panelists from the law firm can share with us how many cases they've used such technology, let's say in the last 6 months or so, and is this a common practice in the law firm on when they are using it and when they are not using it?
It depends whether you mean the stealth use or the open use.
Or the middle of the road use.
Right, or the middle of the road.
I mean, literally, I use it on almost every case. So I've been vetting the predictive coding for a couple of years now and put a lot of time and effort into it. And I've used it on the last 6 months, probably three cases, the true supervised learning predictive coding. I don't like it yet. And again, a lot of that may be, I spent 10 years developing the TAR work, right? So I've got protocols up and down on that. I know how to use, how to identify patterns within data to find the 1% that actually matters, that furthers my case. That I use on virtually every case. So I run the e-discovery practice at my firm, and so most of the cases I have access to, and so I use it literally on every case.
And I can add, non-scientifically, I've been trying to do a free survey confidentially with large companies, and I've had a number of companies have accepted. If they've used the technology, fill out a survey and benchmark amongst each other, sort of pushing the early adopters on and letting the rest of the people figure it out on their own speed. You know, it's the educational issue. Do you teach to this part of the class or this part of the class? And, I don't, and while it's confidential, what we've seen and all that, only shared among the people that are actually doing it, the people that aren't doing it is a lot. There are a lot of people that aren't doing it.
Most, 90%.
But that's why we're here. That's why we have these conferences. That's why we talk about it.
But it's almost sad, right? Because frankly,
sure.
When we use this technology, there's two papers that I'd encourage you to read. They're on my firm's website.
Who wrote them?
Me. That one is called The Demise of Linear Review, and one is called Why is Document Review Broken? Using TAR technology, it just gives you such an incredible up in the case. It's literally, you almost feel bad. It's shooting fish in the barrel on the other side. Whether it's your technology or what you're producing or what they're producing, we had a case literally that I'm doing right now where the other side tried to dump 144,000 documents on us, email, thinking that we couldn't get through them in time. with the techniques that we use, we got through that and had a 20-page report in 3 days. And are destroying the other side with all the stuff they gave us. So to me, this is just a no-brainer that you have to use this technology and learn how to use it well.
And by the way, I mean, I would add to Ben's, because I've worked with that tool, I've worked with some of these things, and we were similarly able to take about 350,000 documents and turn it into a 7-issue report in less than 2 weeks. And it's technology-assisted review, obviously, and very, very good technology, not fully predictive coding, but certainly bulk coding, bulk analysis, those types of things that you can leverage into a much more expedient discovery process.
I think they're also different when I'm here, when you ask about use. I mean, I use it on virtually every case for over a year now. And the early adopters use it, and the people who aren't adopting it are looking. But there are also different use cases. There are people who are using these technologies to order the documents from most likely to least likely to be responsive, and then still using human review on all of them. Some of them are using it for quality control. Let's see if the computer differs from what the human coder says. So there are lots of different use cases, not all of which are using it, in essence, the way that some of the early adopters use it to replace most of that first pass review.
Yeah, I'd echo that statistically. We ran a survey, I think, about 2 months ago on the use of technology-assisted review. We saw out of a representative sample, I believe, about 120, 134 folks from the last time I looked at the numbers on it, a 70% adoption rate of some type of technology-assisted review across the board. It was fairly even between law firm and corporate. What we also saw that was interesting was exactly, Mara, to your point there, which is only 20% were using it to actually make relevance decisions as a direct cause. The rest of the usage cases were all over the board. So they're using it, they're just not always using it for what we think about it for.
The other problem is people use the term technology-assisted review to refer to lots of things. So to some people, clustering means technology-assisted review, deduping, things like that, near dupes. And to other people, it's purely machine learning and active learning. So we've got some definitional issues also.
Dave,
I think it should be called assistive review technology. I'd much rather be artful than stuck in tar.
Dave, as I'm walking over here to hand the microphone to someone else, what's your reaction to people who use keyword culling, then use predictive coding? Is this correct, or is there more education needed?
Well, you know, there was somebody on one of the other panels was sort of making the argument about preserve broadly and collect narrowly, which everyone sort of nodded at. And then they define that as being, okay, you're going to collect all this stuff, you're going to put it in a platform, you're going to index it, you're going to run a query on it, and then you're going to call what comes out of the query the collection. I think it becomes very difficult to defend once you've got stuff indexed in a platform that makes it very easy to do random sampling, to just sort of accept blindly the result of a keyword query and call what comes out of that keyword query, Boolean query, the collection, without evaluating how much you lost in that process, given how much we know about the difficulty that people have coming up with good Boolean queries.
I want to amplify the last statement that Dave here made. If you use keyword culling and you ignore what you didn't select with your keywords, you have no idea how well you did. And that's probably, to amplify again what he said, probably the riskiest part of the whole process. Yeah. So if you're worrying about the 2% or 3% difference of using predictive coding or not using predictive coding or whatever, and you've ignored the 50% part of failing to retrieve the right documents with keyword search, you're just looking in the wrong place.
For the vendors in the audience, bring the price down of loading it into the tool, because they're right now they're disincentives. If it's on a per gig price, nobody wants to take the whole PST and put it in the tool, so they use this keyword searching, which completely botches the whole process up because they've left half of it on the table.
Could not agree more.
Price came down on the loading, people would be more willing to put more data in and let the computer do what it does well, which is the heavy lifting.
I would say people got to use the tools because the company's got to stay in business. So if there's a small number of users, I don't know if it's chicken or egg, but I believe firmly price will come down when the market doubles, when it triples, whenever, because we're talking about software.
To see that, right? Because that's exactly the point. I have found over and over and over again that keywords are horrible. It just is not helpful. Again, there's those few cases that are, but look, even my first and last names are misspelled, so how am I going to find that?
Bennett.
What about mine?
You're right.
Mine's right. It's a miracle.
But we should be careful when we're all these articles are out there saying keywords are bad. Keywords are bad for some things. Keywords are not good for finding everything. But keywords can be very effective for finding some things.
And the whole 1% strategy that I go after, again, it's once informed keywords are powerful, right? Keywords thrown against a dartboard or just people sitting down picking out keywords uninformed, it's ridiculous. It biases your data set. So we've now gotten to the point where we're starting to see the costs come down. It is better for the case, it is better for the client, it's better for the technology to have more data to analyze. So if your vendors are charging you for ingesting all that data at the same price they're doing at the bottom of the funnel of what comes out, get a new vendor.
I want to talk some about the keywords from a little bit different perspective. It's not that you can't do things with keywords. In principle, you could do anything with keywords that you do with anything else. But you have to really work at it. You have to be smart. You have to get the feedback. You have to do the sampling of what you retrieve, what you don't retrieve. If you're willing to spend enough effort, you can do it with monkeys. But the point is, if you spend enough time with keywords, you can make them work. But how are you going to spend your time? How are you going to do you have time to wait? Those are the kinds of questions you have to answer.
Herb, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it with dolphins, not monkeys. I know. My question is a little different. One thing all of you seem to have in common is you are all fervent proponents of this technology. You all believe it's better. I don't think I'm overselling any of you in that. Several of you have published literature that indicates just how deeply flawed linear review, with or without keyword search, is. Agreed?
Agreed.
So at what point is the failure to use the technologies that you're describing an act of malpractice?
Now.
At what point is it such negligence such that our colleagues or your firms or your partners are not serving their clients by the failure to use these technologies, and how are we going to assess those? Where are we going to see that popping up? Now we're seeing it. The other side is saying you're using a technology that isn't reasonably calculated to get me the responsive stuff, the clean products type of approach. Is that, where are we going on that?
Before you answer, I want to say that Craig had dinner with Tom, me, and my wife and a few other people, and he said he didn't think Global Aerospace was that big of a deal, the Virginia case, and the horse went off the tracks. And now you've taken an entire room on, a lot of law firms. So anyway, go ahead and answer. It's just an observation, Craig. I'm stepping away from you now very slowly.
We're certainly not there yet, and I agree with Judge Nolan, who in Clean said she was a believer in Sedona Principle 6, which says the producing party is still in the best position to decide the best process. And look, for I have software that's available to me internally for free, so I can use this on any matter of any size. But there are economic considerations, and there are certain size matters for which it may not make economic sense to do this, and the other way may, you know, be perfectly valid. So I don't think we're at the point where it's malpractice not to use this. I think we may get to the point where Judge Peck decides that you have so much time, or your client says to me, here's my budget, and you may absolutely have no other alternative than to use it. But I don't think right now we're at the point. It's still a disruptive technology, and we're at the very beginning of that. And we still need so much more empirical work to figure out what works and which of these answers are really the right answer empirically, not just because we say so because we're doing it. I think at some point we will get to the point where it's like I can say I have to get to California, but I can't get here for this talk because I'm afraid of airplanes, so I'm just going to take my buggy and my horse, and I'm just going to ride it from New York, and you just wait for me and don't start the conference till I get there. Well, that's not going to fly so well, you know, when there are other options, and at some point the other option is going to become so apparent that you're not going to be able to say, well, I'm afraid, I'm scaredy cat, I don't know that, I don't understand statistics. But I don't think we're there yet.
By the way, I agree with Maura. And first off, I didn't know she had a horse and buggy, but that's it. I think that's right. But I think, Craig, that one of the things that we're going to see, one of the next issues that's probably going to come up, is going to be validation of recall, for example. Did you really produce all of these documents? And I can tell you this. If I get that in a predictive coding scenario and the other side's using manual review, you can bet I'm going to ask for the same thing.
But here's what I agree that the use of this specific predictive coding technology is not using it is not malpractice. Not using the technological resources that are available, and some of these tools, these are not expensive tools, is getting very close. More importantly, not knowing how to analyze a case, find out what the issues are, figure out who is involved, and how to get at the data that matters, that is absolutely malpractice. The 70 cents of every dollar spent on e-discovery wasted, I think it's at least 70 cents. I watch clients spend millions of dollars on absolute idiocy when it doesn't have to be that way. To me, what I find really powerful about this is we are finding that our clients are reducing their e-discovery spend by well over half, but more importantly, they're reducing their entire litigation spend by multiples, because we are getting at the data first, finding out what our clients' positions are. When you find out what your position is, you're out of the case. There's only three positions. You heard me say this a million times. You did it, you didn't do it, or it's a toss-up. It's always one of the first two. If I go after the 1% and get it, and my client did it, they're out. They didn't do it, I proved it to their site, and they're out. So to me, the issue is getting at the answer, which is fundamentally what we peddle in.
I'm going to ask what I think is Craig's question in a different way. Have you ever yet been asked to provide a sample of a null set when you conducted a manual review? And the second part of the question is, do you think in 5 years that you will be asked if you're not using these tools?
I can answer that. I have not, number one, and I actually don't think so, because the human review is so dependent upon each individual, and I would say inconsistent, and it's not a process, so that you really don't learn anything from grabbing the null set of a human review analysis. You don't learn too much. Now, from a validation perspective, I would say, yeah, you might get there, because you're going to want to know whether they found 30, 40, 60, or 70% of the relevant documents. So I think that's the context that you could see it.
I think that's an interesting question for the judges. Would you order, if somebody was an opponent and they wanted to use manual review and I said I want to see their null set, I want to see random samples in the null set and I want the recall, would you order that? You're willing to order it for the predictive coding. Are you willing to order it in the reverse?
No one says I have to be consistent. part of the answer to that is, having grown up in the paper world as a litigator and as a judge, we've never done it that way. And therefore, I would be disinclined to do it. Certainly, since there is, and I agree with Tom on this, there is no process learning out of that. It may be that some sort of random sample looking for errors, and if the errors are too high from that, requiring it to be redone, could well come up. And just going back to sort of why, let me put it this way, in my search forward article, which I can talk about, I had suggested the possibility or likelihood that I would order production of the null set from the seed set. And the reason is, and it goes back to the judges panel, the last thing I want, no offense guys, but is for Dave or Herb or the other scientists to come in front of me with formulas, even if they're able to talk about their black box, so-called. You know, so by looking at the null set, I am able to let the other side be comfortable that they're not doing the GIGO approach to training the system, garbage in, garbage out, or having recently done a panel with Chris Dale and Master Whitaker in London, the British equivalent is rubbish in, rubbish out, which sounds classier, but RIRO just doesn't have a good ring to me.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. If I'm going to appear in your courtroom, it's going to be to explain other things, not the equations. Again, no offense, but they won't do you any good. This discussion earlier, exactly. Earlier in the day, when the question came up, should we be required to explain the algorithms won't do anybody any good. What matters is what goes in, perhaps, and what goes out, certainly. And those are the things that we should be able to talk about, whatever the technology. On the other hand, if you want me to explain the technology, I'll be happy to do it. Another beer. Yeah.
My question is, it seems to be that there's a fear of the technology. Sure. Would you recommend, possibly, to get your feet wet, using the technology on the opposing side's production?
That seems like a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a marvelous way to get up to speed with the tools and learn about the kinds of insights that you're going to get. I think that's a great way to get your feet wet. I mean, another great way to get your feet wet, as was already mentioned, is to use it as a double check on human review. You know, if you think about weighty decisions being made by machine methods, Educational Testing Service used to have two human coders for each essay exam, which decides whether your kids get in college. They have one human coder and one machine now, and only if the two disagree does it go to a second human coder.
And I was going to say, you can do your own little mini trek exercise. Yeah. Take some data that you've already coded by humans that you think was, you know, well done. Ask one of the vendors to run it through their tool, and then look at the ones where there's disagreement, and you decide who. Gordon Cormack and I have a website, actually. What's the link to it? It's something ABA Demo. Cormack at UWaterloo ABA Demo, something like that. Email me, and I'll give it to you.
He just disappeared.
And you can actually go on this website and code documents, and it will tell you whether you agreed more with the technology or you agreed more with the human, and you can do that yourself and just look at the differences.
And I agree with more because I've done exactly that. So every single one of the vendors will do, and they're going to kill me for saying this, but they'll do a proof of concept, depending on the circumstances. We have a test set of data. We did exactly that. I've reviewed it. We re-reviewed it 100 times. We're certain that the coding is right, or at least what we think is right. And we've done several tests, several proof of concepts, and this is where I get these figures from. It's a great way to learn the technology.
But there's a caveat in there, and that is that if your original set was reviewed inconsistently, the results aren't going to come out with quite as high an accuracy as if you reviewed them consistently. Again, Geigel.
So Craig's question about malpractice really made me put on my information governance hat. And I hear you talk about technology, but I think that's only a small part. Isn't it all about people and processes and documentation? And I'd be curious to know what best practices you would recommend in terms of documenting your processes for arriving at your eventual production.
Well, I want to talk about the first part of your comment first. The reason we're talking about technology is because that's what we're convened to talk about. But ultimately, it's the people who make the decisions, it's the people who run the process, it's the people who control the information governance. All the machines can do is to amplify the intelligence of the people who are otherwise using it.
Or lack thereof.
I mean, and so in that sense, one of the big fears that we see in the headlines that are coming out are robots replacing lawyers. We could find other work. Not being a lawyer, but the answer is no, they're not replacing lawyers, at least not the lawyers that you know. They're replacing the anonymous lawyers, maybe, but they're not replacing the lawyers who think legal thoughts. I mean, I've seen reviews where they bring in lawyers because they need to have lawyers to do it, and they tell them, don't think about this. Just respond and not respond, but don't spend any time thinking about it. Those are the kinds of lawyers who are getting replaced.
I just want to say we've hit the end time, but we haven't hit the end time because there's no group after us. And I personally want to thank all the people that have showed up because we're at the last session of the day, and typically this is usually empty. We have a full room here, so I think we've got a great panel here. I'm going to keep feeding some questions out. If you really have to leave or whatever, and I'm not going to do this for another half an hour, okay? But if we go, you know, another 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, are you guys going anywhere? Dinner's at 6:30.
One comment about that last question. The best analogy I like to give is if you gave me the best sports car, that would be kind of not a good thing because I would not be able to drive that around the racetrack.
Better than your buggy.
Yes. maybe not. If you gave the best race car driver a lemon, he's not going to win the race. And if you took the best race car driver and you put him in the best race car and he doesn't know how to navigate, he's not going to get around the track. So you really do. It is people, process, and technology. It is all three of them. And I don't think any of us would disagree about that.
No, I'm a
technology. I got rid of my BMW because I realized that may be the ultimate driving machine, but I'm not the ultimate driver.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a technology guy, but I spend most of my time on process design now because that's where the action is. You know, there's a lot of great technology out there. I think we've got an incredible amount of technology out there from vendors that's nowhere near being exploited in an effective way now. And I still see people taking great technology and making grotesque errors with it. Yeah.
So, Mike, I'm going to go back to the whole question of sharing your null set. Isn't the issue really about understanding the criteria used? So when you're using your traditional keyword searches, you have criteria. One side gives the other side criteria. They understand what the review was based on, what the, you know, what, how the determination was made of, on relevance. When you have predictive coding, I would think that the reason that they're asking for the null set is to understand what your criteria was. So I guess I'm curious to know. It's not, I mean, Herb's argument has been it doesn't really show anything about the technology, but what if I'm not trying to learn about the technology? What if I'm just trying to say, trying to understand, well, you know, how did you decide, you know, what did you decide was relevant? What did you think was not relevant so I can know whether I really believe it's not relevant?
But how's that different if we exchange keywords, you run the keywords, you still have to look at the documents and decide whether ham means this kind of ham or that, you know, whatever the word is, somebody still has to make a relevance determination after the keywords are applied. So I don't see it as any different.
And that's precisely my problem about the whole thing. It's none of their business. They don't get up in my sauce, so to speak. Right? It's not how I make my sausage is none of their business. I have a legal obligation to find relevant material. Again, if I use magic monkeys to do it, it's none of their business. So when they start asking me about how I made my determinations, that's not the question. The question is, I gave you documents. Did those documents have anything in them or not in them that makes you think that I have a problem? If so, then it's your burden of proof to prove it. So I'm very much stay out of my business kind of guy.
Yeah.
No, because I destroy them, right? Because they always make giant mistakes in their data, and it's always, I always go after the data. The data reveals everything. So they make giant holes, there's inconsistencies, there's date holes, there's custodian holes. And then I can go to them and say, here's the problems, fix it. Now, 9 times out of 10, they ask me how to fix it. And that's when I get all in their business, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I'd like to push back on the idea that's come up a couple of times here, that somehow we understood what was going on when people were exchanging keywords. The fact is that you might be able to understand at a mechanical level what the computer is going to do, but the whole point with the keyword queries is that their effect can only be understood in the context of the data. It matters how the vocabulary was used in that collection, what were the other ways to talk about things, what were the other meanings of the words and the keywords. So the idea that you somehow looked at the keywords and you knew how the assessments were being made is not really true, and you always are going to have other means to understand how the decisions are being made.
And I just add one other thing. The reason it doesn't bother me is because I'm not sure there's ever going to be a situation where I'm going to win or lose a case by turning over the null set to find out what everybody thinks is relevant.
But you may lose a client.
I actually don't think so, because my client's going to know it before I ever deal with it, and that's going to be up front. And look, I was explaining to somebody at one point, I think this actually may be a Pittsburgh phenomena, because it's a different practice. Actually, I've said it several times. but it's a different practice. There is a different level of cooperation, I would say, in Pittsburgh than there are in a number of other jurisdictions.
Like New York, you mean?
Or could be New York. Yeah. Could be D.C. There could be certain other locales. But it may develop from a Pittsburgh practice and kind of the way we handle these issues, which is, frankly, I think, less confrontational and more cooperative than you see in a number of jurisdictions. So.
Also, these issues aren't as black and white as we're presenting them. I'm sure all of us have taken different positions at different times. And as Judge Peck pointed out, when you're on the other side, maybe your views change a little bit. But, you know, it's nuanced. Certainly, in government investigations, there may be reasons to take very different, more transparent positions. If you're dealing with somebody where it really is a pretty cooperative, you know, if it was Bennett and I, where there's already trust, we know each other, it might be a very different situation.
But not Tom?
No.
We have another question. You can ponder that.
Hi. Some of the comments in the last 10 or 15 minutes have kind of led me back to Craig's question about malpractice for not using the technology. And in fact, in Craig's presentation earlier, I kept thinking as he was speaking and using language like the technology stepping in as the proxy. And joining that up with some of the comments in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I want to turn the question around and ask, to what degree do you contemplate the possibility of malpractice attaching by virtue of using the technology?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And David, you made a great point. You made a point right here, whether great or not. I'll leave it to you guys to debate. But you said there are many people taking great technology and making grotesque mistakes with it. So my question is, you know, the phrase black box about the algorithm, the tool, the system keeps getting bantered around, but to what degree, in a sense, are you outsourcing legal judgment to technology that is, you know, as lawyers were regulated, the technology is not?
You are not outsourcing judgment. The judgment is the judgment of the person making the decisions. All the computer does is apply that judgment to more documents, take out the tedium of it, not the judgment of it.
But to David's point, wouldn't that depend on a considerable knowledge and experience level?
Sure. Let me just
respond. It depends on the case. It depends more on, at least for predictive coding, there are methods that one can employ that require lots of technology judgments that require you to do lots of things. There are other techniques that you can use that basically the lawyer has to push one of two buttons, and that's the end of the story in terms of technology. It's all legal judgment at that point.
And I want to add a piece in here. I want to play Greg and Cliff adding my observation here a little bit. It's not completely outsourcing, because some litigators have special skill sets where they actually understand technology. And where it gets to be really interesting is when you put someone like that in the courtroom with someone that's trying to learn it. And then it becomes a little unfair sometimes. I joke, it's sort of like if Muhammad Ali were boxing and you put him into an ultimate fighting ring, and if he got the first punch in, maybe he'd win. But if the other guy got a karate move and began choking him on the mat, it might be a different fight. And, you know, that's one of the issues with this technology. If you can combine the lawyer with the understanding of technology, and that may be a next generation lawyer.
And I want to just respond by saying this. I think it's a very important point, and it also goes to the question that John asked, because I can tell you, I don't think you can turn this over to any lawyer and say, look at 5,000 documents and press a button. You can't do it. Moore has been experienced in this for a long time. Bennett's been doing what he's been doing for a long time. You need to have people who understand really what's happening with this, so that you can really trust that they've made the right decisions about what goes in, how to make those decisions, what to look at, what not to look at, when, how to validate it. There are a lot of things that go into it, and just blindly grabbing an appliance, throwing it behind the firewall, letting it fill up, and pressing the button is completely wrong.
And right, it's a marriage between the technologists and the lawyers. You really need both. I call Gordon continually and say, what sample size? You know, and I know a fair amount about this stuff, and I'll still run it by somebody who knows, or I'm seeing this issue, you know, how do we deal with it? You know, I go to my allergist, I get allergy shots. I much prefer the nurse give me the shot than the doctor, because the doctor, it hurts like hell. So we want the lawyers doing the legal piece, and we need the technologists to do the technical piece. And it really needs, you need both components.
And it's what Herb said, right? These tools are an amplification of whatever you put into them. So if you're good at this, it'll be great. If you're bad at this, it'll be a train wreck.
Well, I see a bigger problem. We've run out of beer, and people are starting not to raise their hands. So we're going to end this, but I want to thank Maura, Tom, Bennett, Herb, and Dave for joining us here. Just so I don't have to retape this at home, it's much faster. I'd like to thank Chris LaCour and the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Retreat for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed the program, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our podcasts, where I encourage you to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.